Let's do it.
Blog Talk Radio.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah. Oh 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 oh. Oh oh yeah. The Private Therapy. Host 365 days of motivation and personal empowerment just for you. It's African American empowerment. Marvin Roan and crew. Come on, y'all. It's African American education, African American motivation, and African American empowerment right here just for you. Come on, join me. Call a friend. Oh yeah. Better love. Oh yeah. Welcome, welcome, welcome. There is no better love, no better love than for self and kind. It's African American Empowerment Saturday. We got a great show for you today. We're talking about understanding and evaluating the miseducation of the Negro from Dr. Rogers. You won't want to miss it. Call a friend. Tell them to come on the line. Check it out. Dr. Rogers is really, really exceptional. And guess what? Of course, you already know that Dr. Woodson is the founder of Black History Week, which turned into Black History Month. And so we're going to go into detail about the book, about his writings, about his lectures, about his work, so we can understand the thinking behind the process of creating what we call now Black History Month, right? It's not a month. Come on, guys. Come on, family. It's not a month. It's our legacy. It's forever. It's our history. And so we're going to get into that. But first, attendance of the NAAEA is the National African American Empowerment Association. Some of y'all don't like African American, black, colored, Negro. We all the same. You know who we are. Call it what you want. But the same thing, we got to have a mission to empower our people wherever we are. And we need to ensure that those needs are met through programs and services like this one that motivate, inspire, and empower each person. We got to get better, y'all. We got to heal. But we also have to collaborate and partner with one another. We have to do that work, right? We have to partner with each other. We have to collaborate. And we have to do a better job of motivating and inspiring ourselves to get out of the clutches of the system that continues to work against us. All right, how do we do it? It's the peace concept, P-E-A-C-E. I'm going to spell it for you. Politics. We got to have a political agenda wherever we are, period. We got to understand politics. If we're going to live here and be here and try to strive and survive here, we have to understand the political system. That means law, right? That means policing. That means justice. That means a whole lot of other things. So we have to be able to put ourselves in alignment to understand how to navigate systems. American structural systems, the system of justice, for example, which they say is blind. So you got to understand how you play and how you fit in to that piece of the pie. Next is E, it's education, right? We have to, no, I'm sorry, economics. I should know this, right? Economics. We have to have an economic agenda and an economic platform that creates institutions that define our own reality, that we fund and that we put money into, that we can develop institutions, businesses, corporations, you name it, banks, libraries, whatever we want to do, daycares. You just go down a list of the things that we can create, that we can begin to employ our people. We got to do that. Nobody else can do that for us. We can't. Let's go down to the A. I like this one. Athletics, health, wellness, fitness, nutrition. You got to have a health and wellness fitness program. That's mental health, physical health, emotional health. You just do, right? You got to look at what you're eating, how you're taking care of your body. Are you going to be around to support, educate, train, teach, and develop the next generation? And it's through your habits, your dietary habits. Do you work out? Do you have a fitness agenda? How about that? Do you have an athletic agenda? You have to be an athlete, but you have to have a wellness plan. Right, you got to take care of your temple. You got to take care of your body. Right, we lead the league in health disparities. Right, for a number of reasons. We're going to get into that as we go along in the series. And now culture, relevant cultural programs, period. to educate, motivate, inspire our young people and ourselves to be the best that we can be, to give us confidence, chin up, chest out, proud and confident of who we are, how we look, and just our African features, our African culture, our African history, right? And we're here, so we have to be able to adapt to that. And lastly is education, this comprehensive education. That comprehensive education gives us knowledge and power, because knowledge and power, when you gain wisdom, knowledge and power, nobody can stop you. Now, to Stan Mack in a moment. Hang with
Stan,
us.
Stan, the deck is packed today. I can hear you. Can you hear me?
Yeah, I hear you. I hear you.
Yeah,
I just love it when you're able to explain the pillars of the National African American Empowerment Association. You know, when we have institutions that define our own reality, quit trying to get in to fit in, this is where it's at, and this is what we're doing.
Brother Stan is so right. We need institutions that define our own reality. We just do, but we have to know who we are. This is my plea, right? My brother Stan is gone now, but he's still with us in spirit.
But we must unify.
Tell him, Stan.
Let's not sabotage ourselves. We should not look as to what we can't do. We can do all things. We can do it. And so we got to quit trying to mimic other races and be who we are, original kings and queens, and make a difference.
I like that.
Right here on earth.
That's true. That's so, so true. Are you willing to make a difference? Right? And I know a lot of brothers and sisters out there, but we're going to have a collective consciousness. We're going to have to work together. We're going to have to band together. We're going to have to help each other. We're going to have to heal each other. We're going to have to hold each other accountable, right? Correction for direction, but we're going to have to do it. And now, our Willie Lynch and Kwanzaa segment with Brother George. You know how I got to bring him in. Get ready, y'all. Oh yeah. Come on, Brother George.
Bring it. What?
We ride here.
Oh yeah.
We're not going anywhere. We ride here.
I keep telling them, Brother George, we ain't going nowhere. We're just getting better and getting stronger. How are you, brother?
I'm doing fine, brother. All praise to the God. I'm doing good today. How about yourself? How are you doing, brother?
I'm doing well, doing well. Taking it one day at a time, getting better and better, one day at a time. What you got for us, brother?
Well, today the Kwanzaa principle is going to be near, and near is purpose, to make our collective vocation the building and developing of our community in order to restore our people to their traditional greatness.
All right, I like that. I like it.
Principle, right? It touches your heart to restore our people to our traditional greatness. Man, we need that all day long. And I appreciate the brother, Marlana Karenga, for putting that together. Today, the Willie Lynch moment is going to come from a book by Dr. Naeem Akbar called Chains and Images of Psychological Slavery. And what this is talking about is how images affect us, like the images of God and images that are part of our religion. In other words, Dr. Blyden is suggesting that those Christians who have taken on the idea that the only way to be excellent is to be like Caucasian are the same people who believe that the only qualities that are civilized qualities are those that are associated with Caucasians. Expectations in family life, cultural life, moral life, dress, manners, language, and everything are identified with them as a standard of excellence, meaning identified with white people. There's no dignity in being oneself, suggests Dr. Blasi. Now, he's saying, you know, that if we accept all these standards of beauty, standards of culture, standards of dress of Caucasian people, then we feel like there's no dignity in our cultural life, our family life, our morals, our ethics, the way that we dress. So, too often, the conclusion is reached that the absence of some of these qualities amongst African Americans and the persisting acting of European mannerisms and culture represents a fundamental deficiency in the character of African people. The argument suggesting an innate and genetically determined deficiency among black people are extensive and compelling. Many of the qualities of self-negation and inadequate social development of African people within a European context can be attributed directly as a consequence of the issues of this discussion. In this regard, Imam Waqeen Muhammad raises a penetrating question. What would happen to the minds of Caucasian people if black people would suddenly come into power with their mentality, with their love for their religion? What would happen if nappy-headed black Jesuses were put all over their land and throughout their homes and in all of their churches? What would happen to their minds over a period of 300 years if they kept coming to churches, seeing our image as their redeemer, seeing our image as their prophets, their apostles, their angels? They would be reduced to inferiority because the image before them of the supreme model of superiority would be black and not white. Imam Muhammad places the problem in the broader context of the psychological process in his hypothetical image. The influence of this Caucasian image on the psyches of non-Caucasian people is no worse than would be the influence of black image on the psyches of non-black people. The reduction of people to a state of inferiority represents a reprehensible form of mind control of the worst kind. It also becomes the basis for ensuring the continued psychological enslavement of any people under such an influence. What he's trying to suggest there is that the images of European people in our homes that we see on television all the time, of the people of power, you know, who's important, what is the best kind of culture, all of that affects us and keeps us mentally enslaved, is what the suggestion was there. I don't think that the suggestion was trying to point towards Christians, even though Christianity was used as an example. But they weren't talking about the Christians that accept our culture, that accept our way of life, that accept. They were talking about the Christians that make it appear like if you have keen features, then you're more beautiful or more handsome. Or if your hair is like curly or straight, then you're more handsome or more beautiful. You know, they're talking about those people of color. And so I think that was an interesting analogy, and hopefully, you know, there was something within that to be learned. So, brother, unless you got a question for me, you know, back to you.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you, Brother George. The question is, how do we get to a place where we begin to honor who we are? Our own natural beauty, our own God-given gifts and talents and abilities, and not deferring the gift to other people.
Now, you know, this is really a positive to me because I see more and more of our young people wearing natural hairdos, looking natural. Sometimes, like, when you get the body together to look, sometimes the head will come around. And if you get the head together, sometimes the body will come around. Usually that's the process. When you get put the right thing in somebody's head, then the body comes around. And in other words, the body will display what it is that's in your mind most of the time. But when I see those images, you know, of our young people taking pride in wearing their natural hairdos, I think that that's a sign of something good, you know, for our people as far as learning. I see more and more of our people are vegetarians and vegans. They're trying to eat right and eat closer to the diet of the black man and woman, you know. So our people are becoming more and more educated about ourselves, and we need to keep that process going. We got to keep that process going. And it's going to be more and more of a struggle because of the country that we live in right now. And I think that as we set up our own learning institutions, that's really going to help it a great deal, because I don't think it's a good idea to try to force people to accept who you are, try to force them. You know, respect is not forced on people. Respect is commanded. So when they see a brother or a sister, it's like you see these white senators and representatives getting pissed off with the sister that's up for the Supreme Court. That's only because she commanded their respect. She commanded it. That's why they got to think of lies and all that kind of stuff, you know, to ask her questions, you know, about her past. That's lies. It's not really true. It didn't really happen like that, you know, or bring up issues that's not even really issues. When people start doing that, then you have successfully commanded their respect to pay you that kind of attention. So, brother, that's my answer. You know, we need to continue to flood our young people with the accomplishments and the history of our people and our culture and, you know, what's good to eat and all of those kind of things. And, you know, our future will get bright. It might get worse before it gets better, but it's going to get better when you head down that path.
Thank you. Thank you, Brother George. I appreciate that.
Yes, sir.
That is so, 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 so important to know exactly who you are. We have to know who we are. So before we get to Dr. Rogers, just want to say a few things. You got to know who you are. You got to know who you are. You got to know your gifts, your talents, your abilities, your purpose. What were you sent to this earth to do? It's your time now. It's your season. It's our season for change. We're now identifying with who we are. We're loving ourselves. We're proud of who we are now. We're beginning to turn the corner on understanding the connection between our ancient past and our current past. Our beautiful black selves as we are, and loving every bit of what that is. We're believing in ourselves now. We're loving who we are. And we can love who we are just as we are. And we must learn to continue to love ourselves at a higher and greater level than ever. Teaching our young people, training our young people that they are worthy of success, that they are beautiful just the way that they are. Those lips and those noses and what they call nappy hair, oh, I don't like that at all. It's God's beautiful grass growing out of our heads. Who else can have hair like us? Who else can dance like us and sing like us? But not only that, who can be as intelligent as us and creative as us? Nobody else in the world. sorry. That's just the truth. Prove me wrong. Because all you have to do is go back generations and generations and generations before this moment, and you'll see it. You'll see it. You'll see it in science. You'll see it in mathematics. You'll see it in architecture. You'll see it in every aspect of the sciences. We are science. We are mathematics. But now we have to become love and peace and joy and happiness. That we must be able to penetrate the hearts and minds of our people to see who we really are. And we can do it. It's a challenge, but we can do it. All I'm asking you to do is take a stand right now for your own beauty, for love for yourself, dedicated and committed to a change like never before, dedicated and committed to African-American empowerment. We've been through enslavement, but we're out now, and we're stepping out proud as ever. You be proud of yourself. Love on yourself. And now we're coming up on Dr. Rogers in a minute. You know I'm going to bring him in, right? Dr. Rogers, are you ready? You better bring it because they're ready to listen. Here we go. Dr. Rogers, we're bringing you in right now. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Dr. Rogers, are you there?
Yes, my brother. Yes, indeed. Hotep,
all right. Hotep, 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 how are you?
Doing wonderful. Doing wonderful.
All right. Welcome to the show. I know you got a great lecture for us today, so I won't hold you up. But what I do want to do really briefly is introduce yourself to the audience, right, and then take it from there. Brother George will be live on the line as well. And, again, we welcome you to the show. We appreciate you being here. And, again, we wonderfully and humbly welcome you to give us a lecture. You have our eyes and ears and attention.
Thank you. Thank you so much, my brother. Again, Hotep, to you and Brother George and to the listening audience, this is a wonderful opportunity on a very nice Saturday afternoon to sit back and deal with the history and the tribulation of our people. And I really applaud you and Brother George and what you all are doing with the African American Empowerment Group and the subject matter. I love it. I love what you just said. Know who you are. That's so simple. It's not a complicated concept. It's something that we have to continue to move forward. And I guess that's very clearly what you're doing here in this format. Tonight I'm supposed to talk a little bit about the continuation of the great Carter G. Woodson and his work and his vision and his impact, you know, on the African community. And that's kind of what I want to do. A lot of what we're doing and what we've done in the lectures before this is sort of looking behind the scenes. We're pulling the cover back and looking at what's under a lot of what he's doing and what he did. It's easy for us to just pick the book up and read it, and then you can see what he's doing. But it's another thing, I think, to add to the dimension of how all of this came about. I think as a historian, that's one of the things I've always enjoyed doing, looking at the behind the scenes, the hidden hands, the hidden ideas, the motivation that put Woodson, you know, into doing a lot of what he did. And very clearly, as Dr. Bridges said last week, this kind of opens a door for him when he comes in to do and to respond to his concept of recapturing the African mind. Very clearly, if we understand this idea of Woodson and his comrades and what they were doing, we'll understand what's necessary to recapture the African mind. And you have definitely molded a wonderful idea here, and you have won. So I want our audience tonight, I'm going to get into this topic. If you have any questions, just, you know, write them down. Let's talk about them. Let's don't sit silently on this. This is very, very important. I want to start off by simply saying there has always been a continuity among our people and our thinkers to understand who we are. That was never a void there. coming all the way back from the moments of those ships landing on the shores of Virginia, Georgia, North Carolina, South Carolina, Massachusetts, Washington, D.C., Virginia, wherever they were. When those ships landed, there were people who were engaged into making sure that we always know who we are. And so that's, like I said, it was never a void moment of that. There have been individuals that have diligently compiled the history of our people. Now, what the problem was is that a lot of that information was not accessible to the mainline academia, intelligentsia of this country. It was blocked. It was not welcomed, but it was there. It's just that our work, I had to incorporate finding ways to bring it to the forefront. And that's what you're dealing with here in the African-American empowerment discussion. We are looking at how these individuals were able to do this. There were a lot of great historians before Carter G. Woodson. There were a lot of great historians, both male and female, who were putting together our history before Carter G. Woodson. And there were ways that they were doing it, but just in the time and place of their work and who they were, it was not accessible to the main line of the community. So that's where the problem lies. The problem is how we were blocked from this knowledge. We knew the knowledge. We knew of our greatness. We knew of our history. We knew where we came from. We knew the shores of where we entered. You can see it in those early writings. The problem, again, as I said, the main line. You were not able to pass that on in a continuing way where our children would do it. We have to now go back, look at the Woodson, look at the Du Boises, look at the Booker T's, look at the Murray McLeod Bethune and Murray Church Durrell, and on, and look at some of the things that they had begun to say. And after they went back and did it, because they had to get it from somewhere too. Because with Murray McLeod Bethune and Langston Hughes and Richard Wright and all of those who were writing all kinds of things about ourselves, when Kathy Cullen wrote his poem about Africa, he didn't go there. He didn't know that. Where did he get that from? He had to get it from the others who had written it, that he was able to gain access to that. So that's where that real history comes in, is looking at those individuals. And so that's what we do when we look at Carter Woodson, because Carter Woodson was surely the bulwark of that intellectual process to bring our information to the table. That's a key factor. He started an organization, as I said earlier, the Association for the Study of Africa, where at the time it was the Association for the Study of Negro Life and History. And with that, he did several kinds of things. So today I want to start with just a little bit, because I think that's an opportunity for us to do another discussion on the pioneers, the early pioneers of African history and culture. And we're only dealing with one, Woodson. Woodson, and he trust me, there's a whole bunch of more before him. So, but that's good. We need to deal with Woodson because he did do a major impact for the 20th century and going into 20th century history. Woodson definitely was at the forefront of that. So I want to talk a little bit. I want to use some of the understanding and the writing from a few others that I want to name. There is a brother. His name was George Washington Williams. Now, George Washington Williams was writing in the 19th century about the history of African people. Carter Woodson wrote the 20th century. Dr. John Hope Franklin, before he transitioned, who was operating at the University of North Carolina in Chapel Hill, he was at that think tank working on a book on the history of George Washington Williams. And he did. He finished that. And George Washington Williams wrote a comprehensive history of blacks in America, 17th and 16th century, even those that were not in captivity. And so that would be interesting for us at some point in time to look at the work of George Washington Wiggins. But he did finish that book, and that is available for study and to look at. And then there was others. One of the great historians of our time, and there's not a lot about it, but if you go back in and look at him, he was writing in the 1700s about African Americans, and his name was Prince Hall. Prince Hall was the founder of the Masonic Lodge for African Americans, and that. But Prince Hall was involved in a whole lot more than just Prince Hall Masonry. I mean, clearly that was his cutting edge piece, and it was an opportunity to try to create associations, basically to educate our children. That's what the Prince Hall started to do. That was their initial impact reason, if he wanted to get a couple of men together so that they could build an independent black school in Boston, Massachusetts, to teach our children. That was what he did that for. But anyway, I don't want to get into that. We're not here to talk about him. But that's an important note for us to mention. He is a historian. He compiled a lot of stuff as well, too, because Boston was a global center, and that was because of its shipping. It was where the big ships would come in from Europe and Asia, and people who lived in Boston got a chance to interact with them. That's the reason that the Boston Tea Party and the Boston Massacre and all of that stuff started right there on that coastline of the Atlantic Ocean, because of the fact that it was a cultural network for the world. It was a global shipping center. And anyway, Prince Hall had an opportunity. But that's, again, we can get into that in another later discussion. So what I want to do is I want to talk about these people that were working with Woodson. That was his focus. Obviously, a lot of times when we look at great people and the work that they're doing, we look at them, but we don't realize sometimes that there's 100 people working behind the scenes that's helping that individual. And they would not be able to do anything they were able to do without these folks backing them up, like Martin Luther King. You can't say Martin Luther King headed the civil rights movement. No, he was just one person. A whole bunch of folks behind the scenes that were working, that were making the movement what it was. The one person behind Carter Lee Woodson was a brother by the name of Charles Wesley. And I talked about him last week, but I didn't go into a lot of detail. Dr. Charles Wesley, he was a historian. He was born in Louisville, Kentucky, around 1890. And he attended school there. He was a graduate of Fisk University in the early 1900s. And he earned a master's degree from Yale University. Now, check this out. Dr. Wesley was the third African-American to receive a doctorate from Harvard. The first, Woodson and Du Bois, the first and second, Woodson and Du Bois, and the third was Charles Wesley. So all of these two, three powerful brothers weren't ego-tripping because they came out of a white institution supposedly so intellectually outstanding. But, you know, okay, let's give me Harvard what it's due, and that's the reason that Harvard was that way is because, again, it had global connections. Well, anyway, these three brothers were all graduates. They were working together. They came together to work with Woodson. And so he graduated around 1920, 1925, he graduated. And he served. He was one of the persons who interested in starting or empowering the Alpha Phi Alpha fraternity. As a matter of fact, that was his first piece of work. He wrote the history of the Alpha Phi Alpha fraternity, and it was first published in 1929. It was the beginning of the black fraternal group, because you got to remember these fraternal groups, that all of it was just about being boule and tried to be bourgeois. These fraternal groups were an opportunity for men and women to come together and be secret. Understand what I'm saying? Be secret about what they were doing. And so these brothers and sisters would come together, but in the case of the Alpha Phi Alpha, they would come together to organize. He also was a member of another organization called Sigma Pi Phi Fraternity. And it is actually, is often said, is the oldest African-American Greek letter fraternity. And he also wrote the organization's history as well. Well, when he wrote the history of these two items, he wrote the history of some powerful brothers who had been doing some powerful things in their communities that we will never, ever hear about in mainline history ideas. But the fact that these two books exist gives us a wonderful inside track on early history. And if you would take a look at that, if you were to take a look, you would see that one of the mainline agendas of these groups like Alpha Phi Alpha, Sigma Pi Phi, and what Woodson was starting with the Association of the Study of American Life History, it was about educating black children and educating them properly. Listen to me, brothers and sisters. That's what the early history was about, getting that together. Are we still on that page today? I just throw that out as an idea. We can get into that later. So this is Dr. Charles Wesley's early work. Now, guess what he did next? The next thing, the same, this is the man that worked with Woodson and helped him put together the book, The Miseducation of the Negro. The next thing that he did, he got a fellowship from the Guggenheim. Now, the key to that, again, not being, not trying to showboat, be bourgeois and the top Negro in the house, and that's not what he's doing. The Guggenheim will, number one, give him some money so he can take some time off and go into those archives and go into those libraries that are usually blocked people from getting into them. If he's got a Guggenheim fellowship and he goes to the New York Public Library rare book section, I guarantee you he will not have a problem getting in. So he's equipping himself with weapons that where he can do the research and write the books and get them published that are necessary to teach the history of our people. And following what Brother Marvin and Brother George said, he's helping the African-American community know who you are. In order to know who you are, you got to get the access to our ancestors and the information that they were doing. So once he got that Guggenheim fellowship, he's got a weapon that he can use now. He can go to anywhere he wanted and get in any library that he needs to get into. He did this, and so between 1927 and 1984, Dr. Charles Harris Wesley wrote 24 books. 24 books describing the life of African American people. And he did this from a factual position. This is the man that helped Carter Woodson put the book, The Miseducation of the Negro, together. He was writing this, describing a whole array of things, the African American labor movement, how blacks were involved in the Civil War. He even wrote a book on the history of the Prince Hall Masons, which is how we know that Prince Hall and what he was involved in. He wrote a history of the 15th Amendment, which is the amendment about voting. He wrote a history on the development of black college and black college life. And his first book, the very first book he wrote, was called Negro Labor in the United States from 1850 to 1925. So this is the kind of folk that we are talking about. Wesley was a very successful college administrator. He served as the dean of college, liberal arts, and graduate school at Howard University. From 1940 to 1942, he was president of Wilberforce University in Ohio between 1942 and 1946. And in 1947, he became the first president of the newly formed Central State College in Ohio. And so in all of this, he began to collaborate a lot more with Carter Woodson. As I said, he was the founder, he was one of the founders that helped which put together the Association for the Study of Negro Life and History, which was the largest organization of historians of African American descent in the world. The largest. Dr. Wesley became Witcher's assistant in the 1940s, and he co-edited the Journal of Negro History during this period. He also listed as co-author and continually to update a lot of the books that Woodson was writing of his early work, the things like The Negro Makers of History, which is one of Woodson's books, The Story of the Negro Retold, that's a Woodson book, The Negro in Our History, which is a Woodson book. And a lot of, let me say, brothers and sisters, a lot of these books are still available. You might want to go on and Google. Some of them are free. And you can take a look at it. And so after Woodson's death in 1950, Charles Wesley continued the leadership of the association, and he became the editor of the journal. And he held this all right up until 1965. Charles Wesley became a professor of history at Howard University in 1965, and he served as the director of the Afro-American Historical and Cultural Museum in Philadelphia in 1976, which still exists. And despite his busy professional life, he was also an ordained minister of the AME Episcopal Church, which is another powerhouse of an archival source that looks at Black history. Powerhouse. Because it is the African Methodist Episcopal Church group of people that actually were responsible for finding the first black Negro newspaper in America called Freedom Journal. That was the African Methodist Episcopal Church. Richard Allen, Salem Poor. They were at the forefront. And that's the next source of powerful black archival resource center was the black newspapers, as they began to build. If you want to know the history of anything about African-American people, go into the archives and find black newspapers, because they were writing at the time that it was happening. And there's a powerful array up there that give you all kind of history that talks about it. That was my graduate work approach. I looked at intellectual sources, and the black press was clearly one that I put full attention to and looking at what they were saying about what was happening. And unfortunately, I think in terms of advisory sense, when Nate Parker wanted to do the Nat Turner movie, he went into Virginia and wanted to look at one of the white newspapers to see what they had written. But somewhere, and I'm not quite sure because I haven't talked to him or looked totally at his research process, but someone should have guided him to black newspapers, because they could have really told him what was going on at the time of Nat Turner's rebellion. That's the kind of research history that we're looking at. So that's Charles Wesley. This is the man that very clearly was at the right-hand side of Carter Woodson. Now, Woodson had another person that he did. I want to look at that, and then I'm going to go on a little bit more into the book, and then we'll open up for discussion. There was a woman, that was a sister, that was involved in this research. Her name was Thelma Perry. Thelma Perry was the associate executive editor of Woodson's Negro History Bulletin. As I told you last week, that a part of the association, they had the Journal of Negro History, they had the Negro History Bulletin that he used, and then he obviously had the publishing arm to publish all this stuff, because nobody was publishing black books there. So you had to publish your own. And he did that. And one of the things that she did is she supervised that the Negro History Book. And it was kind of magazine in its book. It was a Jet Ebony kind of thing. And she was operating in a way that supported all of that. She was a history professor. She joined the editorial staff of the Negro History Bulletin and a monthly publication that was, like I said, published by the association. She taught at Texas Southern University, Langston University, and Johnson C. Smith in Charlotte. She was a resident of Washington, D.C., and she was born in Waggoner, Oklahoma, and she graduated from Howard University, where she received a master's degree in history and a law degree. In the 1930s, she practiced law in Washington. Then she returned to academia to study for a doctorate at American University and later at the University of Chicago. She also was a research fellow at Fisk University. She was the author of a book published by the National Educational Association on the history of the American Teachers Association, which was the black counterpart of the NEA, which is the National Educational Association. She also wrote articles and book reviews. And so, as you can see, all of these folks were writing history, and they were writing that history that would be able to tell the story of other history. The National Teachers Association, American Teachers Association, was extremely important because it was telling the damage that was being done to miseducating black children. What was Woodson's book called? The Miseducation of the Negro. Where was he getting the information that it was a miseducation process? People like Dr. Perry, who was studying that, who was part of organizations that looked at that. And even in order for her to do that, she has to also look at the National Educational Association, the NEA. That's some horrible information about what the National NEA was saying about black folk at the end of slavery. Horrible, terrible stuff. Dr. Aoife Carruthers of ASCAP, Dr. Jake Carruthers' wife, did a lot of research on what the NEA was doing and what they were saying. The first convention of the NEA after slavery happened around the late 1860s, early 1870s. And I may not have that date correct, but you can always look it up. They held a convention, and they had a convention in the state that I live in right now, Wisconsin. They held it at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. And at that convention, the whole purpose of it was, how are we, or do we, educate Negroes coming out of slavery? What is going to be done? This is the white group. What do we do? How do we do that? What process is it going to be done? How would it be funded? This was the agenda item of that convention. And Dr. Carruthers, Aoife Carruthers, went in there and looked at the history of that and compiled it, and it is available. I think it's still available online. Just Google Dr. Aoife, I-F-A, Carruthers, and put in NEA convention. And you'll see some of the stuff that was on there. And then lastly, and then I'm going to get into a little bit, what we got now, I don't have a little bit more time. But lastly, because I think this is important, You got to look at this in order to understand anything, what you're doing. You got to put a time and place analysis to things. And I've always told my students that in school, in order to understand anything historical, you got to have a time and place analysis of it. So one of the things that, like I said, that NEA did is it would also determine who's going to teach and how are they going to teach. They didn't have any black colleges in the 1860s. So what were you going to do? So that's why you're getting all of a sudden see all these black colleges pop up all over. I remember my hometown in North Carolina College. It was called North Carolina College, and Dr. Bridges can probably help me a little bit, the North Carolina College for Negroes. at first, and then it was the Negro North Carolina Teachers College or something to that effect. But a lot of them came up like that. Winston-Salem was the Teachers College, and they were all over. They were actually training teachers to teach black folks. But anyway, out of that convention that Dr. Carruthers said, that what would happen is that they believe that it should be left to the states that rule on who teaches and educates black people. And so when they did that, they took it out of the power of the federal government, who had the funds and source to support that, and left it to the states. And you know what states like Mississippi, Georgia, and South Carolina were going to say. So anyway, that's how that was done. So those kinds of historical factors were very important. Now all of this is going on. You must remember that at the time, by the time that Woodson and his group, and by the time that Marcus Garvey is coming into existence, W.B. Du Bois, Booker T. Washington, this country was in the midst of getting ready to go into a global war. The First World War began in 1970. And all of this is developing around a world war. And a lot of this was also beginning around the coming of the Bolshevik movement, Russia, which we got right now. That same Bolshevik spirit is the Bolshevik spirit of that time. Also, the Mandarian spirit of war was coming in. That's the Chinese, the Japanese, the Koreans. All of these were operating at a time when these great minds of ours were working on things of why black folks needed to be educated. Why is it that we needed to get on board with all of these things? This is the whole idea. What was that? And so at one point, when all of this begins to start around the 1916, 1915, 1914, you had a man in office that was a right-out Klan-carrying, robe-wearing, cross-burning president. His name was Woodrow Wilson. He was supposed to be a scholar, but he wasn't. Woodrow Wilson became president in 1913. You know, and, you know, he's the one that watched that film, The Birth of a Nation, and said it was history written in life. And that's the kind of thoughts and ideas that would come. By the end of the 1919, you had the riots were so, they were hanging black people and killing black people at such a rate that the historian, the black historian, whose name is Rayford Logan, he talked about looking at a history of it, called it, it was the Medea of the Negro. And you can look up Rayford Logan. He did a powerful history on a lot of the times that took place there. All of these around Woodson. So what Woodson does is he takes all of these ideas and writings and put them into the Journal of Negro History. And these journals began to circulate about the impact of the war. It began to explain things that we didn't necessarily know. The 19th Amendment was passed in 1920. The 19th Amendment granted women the right to vote. Woodson had an article in there talking about some of that and looking at how that was right. It was important because we didn't have that history from anywhere else and how to do that. And then they were looking at things like the coming of electronic age. Radio was beginning to come in to existence. Around 1920, the first radio broadcast took place in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. There were information about the involvement of that. And then by the end of the 1920s, you get Warren G. Harding comes as the president, the 29th president of the United States. And as many have said, he was a black man. He wrote a book called Warren G. Harding, the 29th president of the United States, talking about his Afrocentricity. Well, a lot of them were black men. That's what Jay Rogers tried to tell you in his book, The Five Negro Presidents. And he talked about why that's important. By 1924, J. Edgar Hoover comes to power. And he comes in going after everybody. The first thing he did is he went after our brother with the Muslim movement, not Elijah Muhammad. It's slipping my mind right this minute. But Noble Drew Ali, he went out, he came out of him with raising guns. And then he jumped over the garbage. He went after garbage. And a lot of his film was to clean up stuff like that. And then Hardin dies, and then Calvin Coolidge. And they said Coolidge actually had a Klan's robe in his closet in the White House. And so, again, they have to be kept. You have to be kept informed of those ideas. So, anyway, that's the process of understanding what Woodson was doing, what our great mind like Du Bois, all of them. Du Bois went down, and I know we're talking about Woodson, but Du Bois tried to create a factory to study black life. So he used the NAACP organization and using the Crisis magazine to create his form of what Woodson was doing. And he went down to Clark, Atlanta. Clark, Atlanta was run by the Methodist Church and the United Methodists. He went down and he attempted to put in a think tank down there. And they published the Crisis magazine, and he published a journal in following in Woodson's step called the Phylon, P-H-Y-L-O-N, the Phylon. And he was addressing some of those same issues. And you can get copies of all of these books, the Phylon, the early things of Woodson. All you got to do is go to the, as I told you before, a database called Gestor, J-S-T-O-R, and you can look at any of those journals and see yourself how that history. And going, and like I said, going back to what we said at the beginning of the program, know who you are. And our people were doing that. So I just asked the question, are we still doing that? Dr. Bridge asked the question, are we trying to capture the African mind? Are you doing that every day? Are we doing something along those lines? Because this is the way that you make that change. You know, as we all sat and watched that vehement attack on a black woman in front of her children and her parents. They were about two steps short of calling her a pedophile. And if it had not been for Cory Booker and some others who came behind to sort of do something, now he didn't attack it the way he should have attacked it, but he did attempt to try to correct some of that. But I hope you understood the historical impact of what she's doing. And why they attacked her like that had nothing to do with the Supreme Court, nothing. It had nothing to do with child pornography. They were attacking her knowledge and her teaching and her understanding of who she is and who her people are. And again, we can get into that. There's a specific reason that they went after Judge Jackson. And it had nothing to do with none of the stuff that came out. And we can, I'll be willing to share that with you at a later date. But right now, we're at that time to open up questions. I know I haven't gotten into a lot of the stuff because there's so much to deal with. But we definitely will. And going right into the merits of the book itself. But these are the merits of the book that I talked about. So with that, Brother Marvin, Brother George, I'm going to turn it over to you.
Well, I want to thank you, brother.
Yes.
I want to thank you. Man, once again, you know, you was impressive. You know, you like I have studied a lot of the history of our people before we came here. And I've always wanted to learn the history of our people on this continent. And I think that I interpreted as though it was mostly going to talk about slavery. But I knew that you had the Harlem Renaissance and you had some other things that was happening with our people. But I don't want to try to take up the listening audience's time because I'm quite sure there's people that have questions. So, Brother Marvin.
Yes, sir. I was just holding back. Dr. Rogers, man, you are a wealth, right, of knowledge. And so as we just look at it, right, the questions that you ask, right, when they talk about how do you educate our people today, right, are we committed to properly educating our children, right? Those things are important, the names that you threw out, right, and the resources that you can go and seek to qualify what you're saying. Dr. Rogers is a professional historian. Dr. Rogers, would you just give them a little bit of your history before we go to the lines, please, so they'll know who's talking to them?
Yeah. I'm an undergraduate of North Carolina Central University, where all of the empowerment of this came from. My mentor was a man by the name of Dr. E. Thorpe. I have a master's degree from University of Wisconsin, Milwaukee. And did the graduate portion of that at the University of Wisconsin, Madison.
All right. So as you can see, listeners.
I taught for 25 years at the University of Wisconsin, Milwaukee, in the Department of Agriculture. And I recently, grade school-wise, I'm from Durham, graduated Hillside High School, 1962. And right there with Dr. Bruce, he didn't. And we got that indoctrination from our people. My mentor was Dr. E. Thorpe, which is also the mentor for Dr. Bridges as well, and some others that I bonded with to learn more. But we used to watch Dr. Thorpe get up before a lecture and talk, and then have one book nor note in his head. He would sit there for hours and talk. Things like that.
Okay. All right. Well, there it is. Dr. Rogers has laid it down. He's brought it, and now it's time to go to the lines. And I'm going to start, if you don't mind, Dr. Rogers, with 6306 at the top of the deck. 6306, you're live on the Empowerment Hour with Dr. Rogers. Welcome to the show. You have a question or comment?
No, not today, but thank you so much, Dr. Rogers, for your insight once again on this Saturday.
Yes, thank you.
All right.
Thank you so much for listening.
Thank you, sister. We appreciate you listening. And ain't nothing wrong with you listening, but we're learning and we're growing. 9282, you're live with Dr. Marvin Rohn, Dr. George, and Dr. Rogers. Welcome to the show. 9282. All right, maybe they're listening today. All right, we'll try to come back. Let's move on down, Dr. Rogers. And again, before we move down to the next caller, you mentioned something about Prince Hall, right, and the writings of Prince Hall. Can you just kind of speak briefly on the tremendous impact that Prince Hall had before we get to the next caller?
Yeah, Prince Hall, as I said, lived in Boston. He had two agenda items that he wanted to do. He wanted to build a school for African-American children where they could be educated in their own environment and taught their own history. So he went to a couple of his brothers around the community, asking them to come together and donate money to let's see if we can build a building. And he was able to come up, and he was able to build to a certain extent. But when he went to the Massachusetts legislature, who would have had to have approved it, they rejected it. He then thought about the ability of starting some type of fraternal group. And so he wanted to look to went to join in the Masons. And he was going to join the Scottish Temple, but Again, they rejected that because he was black. They didn't want any blacks in the Scottish temple. So he was able to talk to someone about letting him start a black version of the Scottish temple, which would be only for African Americans. And it would be called Prince Hall Masons. And that was approved. And again, their idea was to look at building a school along with creating the educational sources. But there was also another agenda item that he had to keep under the wraps. And they wanted to immigrate back to Africa. And he wanted to get together with some folks and buy a ship and a boat and get up out of here, get up out of there. As a result of that, he was able to influence one of his friends, whose name was Paul Cuffy, to get together and let's consider that. And so there's this whole thing between Cuffy and a couple of other people. And as you remember, Paul Cuffy did buy a ship to go back to Africa. Now, this is way before God. So he did buy a ship. But the problem was, is that when this was later, though. This was later years ago. I think Prince Charles was dead by then. But when he attempted to put that ship on the water, there had been an embargo placed on the Atlantic Ocean between the British and America, because that the War of 1812 was getting ready to begin. And the British had begun to attack American ships. And so America put an embargo that nobody could cross the Atlantic without going through that embargo. So obviously, he would not be able to take that ship. But these were brothers that were active. They put their money where their mouth was, and they were attempting to do that. So once that part didn't work out, the next one was to go back to go to Haiti, is to liberate Haiti and create an immigration movement back to Haiti. And with that, you got people like, there was a man named Locke Carey. Locke Carey, if you're a Baptist, you know who Locke Carey is. He was supposed to be promoted as a missionary, but he wasn't a missionary. He was fighting, well, he was a missionary, but he was fighting for immigration. And so Locke Carey would be responsible for trying to go into Haiti and some parts of Africa, and to try to fight for immigration back to those. So that's just a little sketchy. It's more deeper. It's a lot more deeper than that.
Man, do we have something on our hands or what, Brother George? All right, Dr. Rogers. Man, I'm going back to the lines. Brother George, do you have a question before I go to the next caller?
I really was kind of interested you said something about Richard Allen. You know, can you talk just briefly on Richard Allen?
Oh, yeah, okay. Mm-hmm. Richard Allen and Salem Poole were very well-educated men. I'm not quite familiar with it, but you remember they were in Philadelphia. And see, the catch to Philadelphia is that the Quakers were in Philadelphia, and the Quakers did not believe in slavery. They were Germans, however, but they were more supportive of underground liberating ideas, and so they put their money and funding and helped to a certain extent now, to a certain extent. You got to look carefully at that. Not all ways, but the Quakers were supportive of African liberation to a certain extent. And so the Quakers were supporting in terms of giving real estate and buildings. So when, you know, when they started Bethel, Mother Bethel AME Church, they started that in a building. And I mean, it was a big church building, donated obviously by some folks with some funding, because most of the black churches were that existed at that time were what Albert Rabiteau called invisible institutions. That means they didn't have a building. They met out in the woods back by the lake. And when Mother Bethel started, Mother Bethel, and Mother Bethel wasn't the first brick-and-mortar church either. It was a Baptist church down later, I don't remember, maybe Dr. Briggs can tell you where it is, down in Alabama, I believe, somewhere like that, that was a brick and mortar church. But anyway, so Richard Allen, because of his education and his training, he and Salem Poor had the support of the Quakers.
Right.
To help with a lot of, yeah.
Thank you.
So that's how that came about.
Okay, well, let's go back to the lines. Let's try 6511, 6511. You're on live with Dr. Rogers. Do you have a question or comment? Welcome to the show. 6511, going once. All right, Dr. Rogers, I think they're just listening today, and you can't blame them for that because it's so much wealth. I have a ton of notes here. All right, let's go over to 0148. 0148 is question and answer time, or you can just make a statement. Do you have a question or comment? You're live.
A question. First of all, good afternoon, everyone, and it's always a pleasure to hear you, Dr. Rogers, always.
Yeah.
The question that I have is under the auspices of how to do. It's one thing to come across the names and the dates and the places. My question is, can we look at how to do these things with regards to studying chronologically the events that may have happened, or going to a part of the world and saying, okay, there were human beings at this part, at this time in the world. How do we kind of look at the extensions of things that were going on in that environment at that time and the kinds and types of people that traveled across that area? So how do we really kind of look at studying history at all?
Good. That's a good question. Oh, that's a very powerful question. Like all of your questions you said, Brother Lester, that's why I appreciate you so much. history, it's like John Henry Clark said, history is a clock. And it tells you your place and in terms of the times of human events. That's why I did that chronological piece of the fact of what was operating around the time that Whitson and all of them were building. And it also is like a blueprint. And a blueprint is a pre-printed document of what something might look like, as you know. And so when engineers... Excuse me. So when engineers and builders are looking at actually creating the building, they have to look at the blueprint first. They have to look at the way the shape and design is and how they are going to place supporting and foundations so that that building can go up. So it kind of answers your question. History has to be done the same way. You have to look at a foundation. If you wanted to be a Nat Turner and do that, what Nat Turner did, you got to study carefully, in detail, the blueprint. And the only way to do it is to do what we're doing right now. You got to understand that there is a... First of all, you start with the biography of the person that did what you want to do.
Mm.
What was behind him? What was he all about? And so you're right. You want to make these things happen. You want to go out and you want to create new institutions. But if you want to create a Tuskegee, you're going to have to look intricately at Booker T. Washington. And you're going to see that it wasn't Booker T. Washington. It wasn't no hero worship thing. There was a whole bunch of little farmers down in Tuskegee who were trying to survive, and they needed a laboratory to get somebody to help them grow some food. And he was just chosen as one of leadership because of his background and education out of Hampton Institute to come down to Tuskegee and do that. But the people that were behind getting the money and getting the crazy white folks of Tuskegee to leave them alone while they do this was not Booker T. But you got to go read that history first, and you got to read that blueprint carefully. A lot of us don't even know that. We think Booker T. Washington built it. Booker T. Washington didn't build Tuskegee. You know, and that's a misnomer that we have a lot of times about our history and about putting things in place. Marcus Garvey, one of the most successful movements that there has been. Have we really studied Garvey closely and looked at that blueprint and looked at all the cracks and corners of it and understood what it took, understood that Garvey could have never done what he did if those women didn't back him up?
Come on, Rogers.
And most of them,
tell
they get along with our women. You be fighting them women. We be fighting women all the time. Oh, wish the women shut their mouth. They don't know what they talk about. All they do is talk. Blah, 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 blah. Garvey knew better than that. Those Black Cross nurses, they weren't just about hospital stuff. They were about nutrition, what Brother George, Brother Marvin says every day, about eating right. They were developing plans and activities to help young 18 and 19-year-old mothers feed their children more quality food. When they came along, mothers were still feeding them kids out of slavery. They were still feeding them fat back and grits and stuff that was killing them. They talked about more natural food. They put in place pamphlets and ideas. The same thing George Washington Carver did. So that, Brother Lush, I hope that gives some insight, is that you have to study that blueprint. That's what history is. History is a blueprint of how to put things in action. You want to build a Tuskegee? Cool. Build it. But it ain't going to be about you going out here getting a truck full of bricks and throwing it and cook butter and buying some land and putting the bricks up. That's more to it than that.
So all right. Thank you, Dr. Rogers. Thank you. Great, great answer. So it's so much to learn because reading is so important. Reading is so important to our people now. We got to understand the importance of reading to be able to sit down and read and study and research. All right, Dr. Rogers, great answer. I'm going over to 7841. 7841, you're live. If you have a question or comment, Dr. Rogers is available. All right, I'll go down to 9011. Do you have a question or comment? All right, well, looks like they're listening today. And that's a good thing because they're on the line. All right, I'm going down to 9770. You're on live. Do you have a question?
I don't have a – I guess the only comment is very interesting, and I'm only hearing parts of it because I'm riding on a train, so it's going
okay.
In and out. But very interesting. Thank you so much. Thanks, Dr.
Okay, thank you for calling, sister.
Yes. Thank you so much, my sister, for listening.
Hey, thank you, sister. That sister is on the train trying to listen. That tells
right.
you what we got on this line here, right? We got a sister that's on a train that's going in and out trying to get the information to empower and inspire and motivate herself and her community. Thank you, sister, for listening and for all you all who called today. Dr. Rogers, let's go back to you for a minute as we get into winding down the show. Again, great, great, great information. There's so many areas to go into. Right?
Yeah,
there's so many things to talk about. Yeah, yeah. So let's talk about briefly before we wrap it up, and maybe this will be another conversation as we continue to link these things together. Let's talk about the Black Press for a moment, right? How important was the Black Press then, and make a good comparative analysis to where we are now, if you would.
Okay. Well, number one, let's use Brother Lush's question the spirit of his question. And that's just, how do you look at it as a way to do something now? The number one key to understanding the black press of America were the publishers.
Hmm.
A lot of those publishers were crusaders. They had a consciousness of changing the minds of our people. They were trying to capture the African mind.
Hmm.
That's who they were. So when you look at people like John Rushmore, as we said, when you look at even towards the modern day, Brother Semstack, who had the Chicago Defender, which was the only daily black newspaper in the country ever. A man out of North Carolina named Lewis Austin started a paper called the Carolina Times. His motto was truth unbridled.
Mm.
These were pioneers. These were men who single-handedly wanted to get out here and do something, but they needed a voice. Ida B. Wells, as a journalist, and I kept to start it in lynching. There was a brother, his name was T. Thomas Fortune. He was the editor of many papers, including Marcus Garvey's Negro World. Because they know that you need an organ. You need a voice sometimes to reach out. You have created a voice, Brother Marvin, called African American Empowerment. You're reaching out into the waves of our people where somebody on a train would want to hear you. That's the key to understanding the black press. And there were many papers that out here who those editors, if you looked at the editors, the paper is one thing, but the editor and the approach that they took, Mary McLeod Bethune, Mary Church Terrell, all were involved in black newspapers. The African American, the African Methodist Episcopal Church had a newspaper. The NAACP had a newspaper. The Urban League had a newspaper. The Nation of Islam got a newspaper. It's an organ. It's a voice. It's an axe. It's your shotgun. It's your AK-47.
Mm.
You can take that whole bunch of stuff with a newspaper. That's why they shut it down, most of them. And the way that they had, and see, here's the key about that publisher, the way that they would come at and shut your paper down if they don't advertise in it. And if you don't advertise in it, then how do you pay the printer? So you got to be prepared to go in your pocket.
Mm.
So again, going to Brother Lush, how do we put these things in place? You have to have the mindset. You have to be able to realize you're not going to make no money. You're going to have to use your own resources. So as you launch out here to put it in action, you can't be begging and crying and screaming and hollering. You got to use your own cash like you have to do. When I do my radio broadcast, I get no money from nobody. I do my own. I got to be prepared to put my own thing in place. Every now and then you get some folks will come along and say, let me help you out a little bit, put something here. That's fine. But I can't count on that. I have to count on me and the energy of what I'm trying to accomplish by doing a radio broadcast.
All right.
So that's,
well,
that's,
there it is. There it is. I mean, Dr. Rogers, thank you so much. You've done a great job. And, of course, you know you're on cycle. And so we'll have you back again to have another part of looking at breaking it down of what Dr. Woodson did. And here's the interesting piece for me as I continue to analyze myself, is that what I took away from this today is that Dr. Rogers is telling us about the history behind the history, the people behind the people. Right? It's the you and me's of a movement. It's not the Dr. King, it's the people behind him. And so you have to understand that the people are so important. All right. So thank you, Dr. Rogers. We'll give you a final thoughts before we wrap it up here.
Well, again, thank you so much. This is empowering. You've been Brother George. Brother George stayed on it, made sure that I understood the time that I was supposed to come on. I appreciate that. This is what we have to do, my brothers and sisters. We have to do this, and we have to do it in a way that we can reach and get to our children. They do not know any of this stuff. Many of them do. I have grandchildren. I have a lot of grandchildren. And I'm frequently asking them about things and see what they know. And I have a set that are very smart. They're very sharp. I called one of them the other day, and I asked him, does he know anything about what's going on with the Supreme Court? And he said, no, he didn't, but he knows about the Voting Rights Act. And he's 12 years old, 13. And so I said, okay, that's good. I want to talk to you about the Voting Rights Act. So you got to talk to them about it. They're not too young. I need to tell my 9-year-old granddaughter about Mary Church Terrell.
Mm-hmm.
And Sojourner Truth. But we're not doing that. Why? Why aren't we doing that? Are we afraid of something? And I'm willing for you to stand up and say, well, I am doing it. Don't tell me I ain't doing it. I'm doing it. I'll humble down to you. I we got to see it. So anyway, I appreciate it. Appreciate the opportunity. I'm empowered. You said it's the African empowerment. You empowered me to talk about it.
Thank you, Dr. Rogers. We appreciate you. All right. Before I get to Brother George, we got Dr. Bruce coming up again next week. Tell a friend. We got Dr. Rogers coming back again and a number of other people who are going to come and educate you. It's about education. Brother George, final comments.
Well, brother, it's been a great show, and I appreciate all that you do. And that's me.
Yes, indeed.
Well, that brings us to an end of the conclusion of another show. You heard it today. There's so many takeaways, so many things to learn, so many things that we have to go back and retool. You need resources. Dr. Rogers said you need a newspaper. That's your hammer and your nails. You need good people behind the scenes. You need knowledge. You need somebody who's willing to do the research and then go back and give it to the person who can give it to the people. Everyone has a role in the process. At the NAAEA, it's about education. We have to educate our next generation. How will we do that? With knowledge, with power, with information, with inspiration, with motivation, with empowerment. Those things we need. And today, here today, you got a lecture on the blueprint. The blueprint is there. He said it clearly. We have models. Let's look at the models. Let's examine the models and then come up and deviate plans or devise plans that will allow us to do the work of creating change in our communities right where we are. And again, let's not deviate to go back to the old ways of depending on other people to create realities for us. We got to do it for ourselves. And it's people like Dr. Rogers and Brother George and all of you who are on the line, who are willing to sit and listen and learn and take notes and improve yourself. That's what it's all about. And as we wrap up today, continue to dig, continue to research, continue to inspire, continue to change, continue to grow, continue to be the best person that you can be, because it's all about the empowerment of a generation, this next new generation that's here, that are standing on the shoulders of a great ancestry. Those who fought, bled, and died. Those who suffered. And those like you and me who are African-American in heritage, who can stand up and say, I'm proud to be black. And I'm black and I'm proud. Until next week, brothers and sisters, peace and blessings. Do your thing, Marvin Rome. Do your thing. Peace.
Wait.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Thank you, Dr. Rogers. Peace.
Peace.